Reset your system clock to 1992 and join us on today's multimedia hyperguide tour of Windows 3.1. Hi again, folks. It's your friend SuperVGA again. I am here today to talk about the classic time waster for Windows, LucasArts' Indiana Jones and His Desktop Adventures. So finally, I'm here to talk about the game that I've been promising for quite some time. You'll probably notice that the podcast is out a couple of days late. That was actually very intentional. Well, unintentional. I forgot that it was a public holiday in Canada called Canada Day. We kind of celebrate this as the coming together of the nation. And most, if not everyone, takes a couple of days off for a long weekend to enjoy it. And I did. I took a few days off with my wife and spent some time with friends and family. So that was wonderful. So thank you for your patience in waiting for the episode to come out. Now, today I don't actually have any listener mail to tell you about, so I'll skip the whole community memories section. Please write in. I know a few of you have mentioned to me through IMs that you'd love to write in and just tell me about some memories you have of the Windows 3.1 days. Just right away. I'm so happy to hear from you, so whenever you get a chance to send an email, I will be happy to read it on the air. Let's skip straight to the inventory check. I got something really fun today. I'm going to have to dig this out here. It's buried at the bottom of my boxes. I have for you a brand new or newish copy of Netscape Navigator Gold Personal Edition Premium Internet Suite designed for Windows 95 and also, more importantly, Windows 3.1. This is the CD-ROM version. I'm assuming that this must have also come out in a diskette version as well. I am so happy to have this because I plan on doing a future episode of it. Now, why would I want to buy a 25-year-old piece of software that no longer even works properly on any web page you could ever visit, except this podcast's webpage, which was built with it? This is a really important piece of software history. I'm opening up the box here. It's actually surprisingly full of stuff. There's the CD, of course, copyright 1994 through 96, Netscape Communications Corporation. Sad to say, Netscape, you didn't survive long past 1996. but inside is actually chock full of manuals. This was the reason that I actually purchased this, aside from the fact that I was hoping to have an officially licensed copy of Netscape to use to build the website. Don't tell anybody, I actually used an abandonware copy to build the site because I didn't own this yet. But it comes with an authoring guide, which it's really fun. It walks you through, I'm flipping through it here right now, it walks you through how to build web pages using a WYSIWYG environment, otherwise known as what you see is what you get. It tells you about some basics that people might not have understood in 1996, like drag and drop. I thought this is going to be wonderful to talk about in the episode that I'm going to do on Netscape, the history of Netscape, or a history, a personal history of Netscape is maybe a better way to put it, because I wanted to kind of demonstrate to everyone that in the early and mid and late 90s, you couldn't take for granted that people would understand what HTML was, what a web browser was, how you use a TCP/IP stack. So I thought I would pull out the original documentation to give everyone, including myself, a better sense for what the average person in the late 1990s understood about the web. And also, just to see some of the really funny stuff in here, for instance, on how to use Netscape Personal Edition's auto dialer, which is really funny. It actually had a, I think I'm going to have to read through this in more detail, but it looks to be a slip PPP dialer. Again, that was a tool you needed in order to connect to the internet over your modem in the late 90s. It tells you how to set up your DNS configuration. This is a nightmare to people today who basically have set it and forget it ADSL and cable modems. You plug them in, you hope for the best. Back then, it wasn't so straightforward. So I'm really excited to talk to you about Netscape in a future episode. And beyond that, I've actually been reading a book on the history of Netscape, pulling it off my shelf here. It's called Netscape Time with Jim Clark and Owen Edwards, published by St. Martin's Press. This is a history told from the perspective of Jim Clark, ex-CEO of Netscape. I think it's a really fascinating read, and I can't wait to talk to you about that in a future episode. One last thing, I've got my show notes here, which I thought was quite funny. I noticed this on the back of a sticker on the bottom of this box. It actually, did I find something else in here? Oh, I think I just found the CD sleeve. Yeah. On the bottom of the box, there's a sticker. It says, not for export outside US and Canada. I think that's a really fascinating piece of history in itself. I suspect I understand what that's about, but I will talk about that in a future episode. I think that has a lot to do with the 128-bit DES encryption algorithm used in Netscape Gold. The U.S. laws prohibited the export of encryption algorithms over a certain threshold. I believe it was 56-bit. Don't quote me on that. You weren't allowed to export any algorithms that exceeded the 56-bit standard. 128-bit was like the gold standard back in that day for SSL communications. So anyway, I'm really looking forward to that episode. That's going to be coming up soon, probably not next week, but in some future week. So if you have any stories about Netscape, either Communicator or Navigator, I believe this is Netscape Navigator 3.0 that I've been looking at, please write them in. I'd love to hear your first or early experiences using the web and Netscape. So moving on to the main little intro story that I like to talk about. So it was 1996, and I was a teenager at the time. I was hungry for a summer job. I was probably in grade 10 or 11. I think that would be grade 11 for me. And I had an uncle in the far north, and my uncle promised me that he would talk to his best friend who was opening up an internet service provider for the Arctic. The Arctic, for anybody who isn't familiar with the Canadian landscape, is this area of Canada north of a certain latitude. It is very dry, very cold, and has very, very long winters. And this friend of my uncle's had planned to service the entire north using a combination of satellite dishes, microwave antennas, and traditional copper wire to spread the internet. This guy was way ahead of his time. I mean, keep in mind that the internet was just getting a foothold in the main parts of Canada by 1996, and this guy was already thinking about how we could, bring the internet to rural communities in the far, far north. So the way it worked was he had put in this gigantic 20,000 square foot building in the middle of nowhere. I really do mean in the middle of nowhere. It was in a town of less than 500 people. And this huge warehouse was beautifully built and designed to house an internet service provider as well as a computer, a hardware company. He was kind of doing both in his company. The idea was that people from outlying areas would connect to his ISP over telephone lines. And remember, this is the far north, so you're not able to dig underground to bury in copper wire. It's also extremely expensive to carry copper wire over long distances. And I assume there's also a technical limitation there too, carrying it over traditional telephone lines. I assume you have to use some really complex repeaters and stuff like that. So the North elected, or the NWT, what would I call that? The Northern Telecom elected to use microwave antennas. These were huge drum-like things mounted on the tops of antenna towers. So this was all very, very new and very exciting to me. I had already been on the internet for a couple of years, but the idea of it being in the far north, connecting over these wild microwave wireless antenna towers, was pretty cool. To make a long story very, very much shorter, I'll cover other aspects of that story in another podcast episode. I got a job working for my uncle's best friend, helping to start build this ISP. What I loved about it was that I, of course, had access to very, very fast internet for the time. I worked for this guy for two summers, and I was absolutely in love with this job. I was making decent money as a teenager. I think I was making minimum wage. However, as part of the deal for working up there, and it was in fact the only way my mom would agree for me to go work up there, was that I had my own place. My boss rented me a trailer basically for free. He also gave me free access to the company restaurant, which I absolutely loved because although I knew how to cook, I mean, what teenager doesn't like free food? So I'd go to this restaurant every single day for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. It was heaven. It was like a miniature Google in the middle of the Northern Boreal Forest. But most importantly of all, to me, I had access to very fast internet for its time and the fastest Gateway 2000 computers money could buy. At the time, the fastest computers that we had at the business were 200 megahertz Pentium Pros. These were way ahead of the curve. The average person in 96 was probably using a 486. They had probably even upgraded to a regular Pentium, Pentium 60, 75, Pentium 90, pushing the limit, a Pentium 100 or 133. But we had a Pentium Pro in most of our machines. These were incredibly expensive. They were Pentiums with a slightly different architecture, if I remember correctly, much faster cache and much more cache. So I was in pizza face paradise at this place. Fast computers, fast internet. My job was working in the tech support department. I worked there all day, and I would take a quick break for lunch and a quick break for supper at the restaurant across the street. And then I would go back straight to work and stay there until 2 and 3 in the morning every single day. Not working, of course. I mean, this is after 5 p.m. The first thing I'd went back is and do is play Quake. Or I think I had Mech Warrior 2, a few other of the big games at the time that I would just go hard on all night. The other thing that I was doing other than actually playing games was enjoying these ultra-fast machines. I only had a 486 SX33 at the time at my home. This was the PS1 that I always talk about. But at work, or at this workplace, I was downloading wares like crazy because we had a huge pipe compared to my home dial-up modem. At home, I was still using, at this point, a 14.4 dial-up modem. Most people by 96 probably had a 28.8 modem. I was a little bit behind the curve there. But at work, after 10 p.m., there was kind of an agreement with my boss that we wouldn't abuse the internet prior to a certain time, just because we wanted to give our customers maximum speeds. After 10 p.m., traffic over our ISP slowed down. And get this, I could get 256 kilobits per second off of this pipe. That is 32 kilobytes per second in terms of download speeds. I believe the upload speeds were the same too, but I didn't upload a whole lot, to be honest. sure, that's not quite the crazy T1 speeds that my mom's university got if I was at the university lab. That's another story for another time. The T1 would get about 1.5 megabits per second. But these dual ISDN lines that carried all of our customers were about 10 times faster than the best possible speed I could get on a 28.8 modem at the time. I seem to remember our service carrying a lot more than, let's say, 10 or 20 people on dual ISDN lines. I suspect that's because due to the fact that our customers were hundreds and hundreds of kilometers away over microwave lines, microwave antennas, the best speeds that they could hope for, even on a 28.8 modem, were probably quite low. So that meant we could have a lot more users on. Let's say if they could only get 1.3 or 2K per second off of their phone line, we could have a lot more than 10 people using dual ISDN. And plus, you know, of course, when, long story short, you can squeeze a whole lot of people onto dual ISDN lines in 1996. Back to the main story, Wares was amazing. I would spend every night for those 2 months during my summer break on IRC channels like Pound Wares for All or Pound Wares Free DCC on this IRC network called EFNet. I would wait in queue with these things called DCC bots trying to get the latest and greatest stuff. I'm going to do an episode, I'm really excited about this, on an IRC client for Windows, I want to say the IRC client for Windows 3.1 called Merc, or as a kid I just called it MIRC, I didn't realize it was called Merc. That was one of the most amazing packages, software packages that I ever used, and I put thousands of hours into this. I sadly never paid for a copy because the first thing I would do would be to crack Merc when the new version came out. I apologize to the developer. I'll have a lot to say about the developer. He's a really interesting guy. Again, for a future episode, I went crazy with the Wares. It also helped that I had a coworker in tech support. He was a guy named Mac. He was a techie type in his mid-20s. Keep in mind, I was about 16, 17 years old at the time. But Mac was into Wares just as much as I was. He would go home in the evenings. He wouldn't stay at work. He would spend all night downloading Wares over his... I actually think he had a 33.6 kilobaud modem at that point. So he was pulling things down pretty quick. Not as quick as I could off of the... Not even remotely as quick as I could over the company ISDN lines. But he was leeching like crazy. And what he would do is... Every night he would download something new and bring it back to work the next morning. And we would compare notes. We'd say, oh, what did you download? What did I download? Well, one day he came in with a single floppy disk and said, don't ask any questions, buddy. Just copy this. And I was not impressed. I was used to seeing shareware games that could fit on a single disk. But you didn't see a lot of commercial AAA studio games on a floppy past 1990. This was 1996. By this point, I seem to remember that games would come either on CD completely, or if it did have a floppy version, you'd be looking at an install of 10 3.5-inch high-density disks. So one 3.5-inch high-density disk, that seemed a little sketchy to me. So I popped in my copy and I launched it. Surprisingly, it was a Windows 3.1 game, and this was a rarity, or this was becoming a rarity, in a time where the mass majority of games were played in DOS still, or, you know, Windows 95. Even Fallout would come out a year later in 97 with the DOS version, so the fact that I was seeing a Windows 3.1 game well after Windows 95 was already out was very strange. I was pretty nonplussed by what I saw when I first loaded it. It looked like the kind of game I could have made myself in Visual Basic 4. The menus were all 3.1 styled, and the in-game dialogues were rendered with a speech bubble that had kind of scrolling non-anti-alias text. by this point, Windows 95 had been out for quite some time, and I came to expect much higher visual quality out of what I was seeing. And you know, when you see that those blue scroll bars, you think your immediate thought is Windows 3.1. Oh no, this is a big step backward. Well, this was Indiana Jones and his desktop adventures. I ran Indy around on the screen for a few minutes. I found a gun and shot a few meandering pistoleros and recovered a sacred artifact. All told, I think I played maybe about 20 minutes, 15, 20 minutes. Mac kind of stood by and watched me play, and I shrugged and said, it's okay, I guess. It looks like The Legend of Zelda for Windows with kind of crappy graphics. But the funny thing was, I went for lunch, and, you know, at the restaurant across the street, my favorite place, I'd have a, you don't need to know what I ate for lunch, but I ate the same thing every day. after lunch, I came back to the tech support workbench and started pulling apart a computer a customer had sent in. They were complaining about something wrong with the parallel port, and I was supposed to test the parallel port, make sure that it wasn't the some hardware wrong with the motherboard or some IRQ setting that got messed up before I went on to testing the printer. Well, we ran an in-house diagnostic kind of batch of, I think it was Norton PC Tools and a couple of other custom things written for us to test out the hardware on the motherboard. This test cycle took about 15 minutes to complete. And this was always boring because this would tie up my workbench for 15 minutes. I could switch over to my other workbench PC, but sometimes we get a little worried that our boss would come in seeing us downloading wares during midday when we're not supposed to be using the ISDN lines for that. I think he secretly tolerated it at night. But I was bored, and instead of cruising IRC for DCC bots, I turned my workbench and ran Indiana Jones and his desktop adventures. And I was just thinking, okay, fine, I'll just replay the same quest. It'll just kill some time. The funny thing was, when I loaded it up, Marcus, I'll talk about the quest giver, Marcus, from the movies, asked me to find a different ancient artifact. Okay. I stepped outside of town, and in fact, the surroundings were completely different. It was a different map altogether. I thought I was dreaming. And the more I explored, the more I was surprised that the map had been completely generated differently. In fact, all the enemies were different too. All the pathways were different. The character said different things to me. There was still, you know, familiar things. There was a tent full of Nazis with Nazi guards in them, etc. But for the most part, it was a slightly different experience. And it was really strangely addictive. So for the rest of that summer, whenever I had 15 or 20 minutes to kill, I'd inevitably load up Desktop Adventures and go on some new quest that Marcus gave me. And there was something undeniably addictive about it. So today I'm going to talk a little bit about the game, its design, its style, its history, and some of the technical things that I found out, as well as I'll talk about an interview that I found with its creator, Hal Barber. So, style. The Indiana Jones franchise has quite a few different types of games. There are the point-and-click adventures like Last Crusade and Fate of Atlantis. I'm assuming most of our listeners will be familiar with those. There's the slightly lesser-known 3D action platformers like Infernal Machine and Emperor's Tomb. Those are surprisingly good games, at least the first one is. There are even a few 2D platformers like The Young Indiana Jones and Indiana Jones's Greatest Adventures. Those were console titles. They didn't receive a port. And the old Atari arcade game, Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom. This was an original arcade game that was ported to other systems, including DOS, I believe. What surprised me doing this research was that there's an officially licensed text adventure called Indiana Jones in the Lost Kingdom. This came out in the early 80s. But all of the games released with Harrison's face, you know, but of all of those games with his face on the cover, Desktop Adventures has the most in common with the earliest licensed Jones game, Raiders of the Lost Ark for the Atari 2600. And that's because Raiders of the Lost Ark is a top-down adventure puzzler. This is the Atari 2600 game. It's something like a cheap-and-down version of The Legend of Zelda. Now, Desktop Adventures is very similar in that it is a top-down adventure puzzler, and it uses to improve, you know, on the experience, the WinG graphics library. So this is a 256-color game, which is what we would expect of at least of the late 1990s. What I liked about the style is the top-down interface has an extremely cartoonish Indiana Jones in the center. He's got kind of this bobblehead and tiny little body. In fact, all of the characters in the game do. Everything's cartoonishly out of proportion. Indy, for instance, his character is 1/5 of a house's width, and, you know, the I think it's 1/3 the width of an outdoor fountain. So, it effectively, Indy is 15 feet tall and 10 feet wide. The color palette, I like this, borrows from a desert theme. It's got a lot of browns and taupes and yellows, which is a little on the boring side. But what it does is when you have those warm colors, it makes cold colors like greens pop really well. Greens and blues pop really well off of that, as well as this is greens for highlights like forest and I think there's some bamboo there too. Then there's also red Spanish tile on the roofs of the town buildings, and these really pop out, you know, in relationship to the kind of desert floors as well as green trees. Despite it visually not being anything comparable to what came out in the late 90s, I mean, consider the fact that games like, you know, Full Throttle and Day of the Tentacle were leaps and bounds beyond this at an earlier point. I think even The Dig was out by 96. It's still somewhat attractive. There's something hard to explain that it is very enjoyable. Now, it's nothing to write home about, but I think the artists put quite a bit of work, as much as they could, into getting this right for, like I said, that cartoonish look. It came out in 96, and I would say it looks more like a game you'd find in 1992, to be honest. Now, story. So this is the storyline that kind of comes from the help file, because you don't really get a story, and I'll talk about why. At least you don't get a linear story, and I'll talk about why a bit later. So, it's the mid-1930s, and Indiana Jones, PhD, excited by the fantastic finds emerging from the deserts and jungles of Middle America, travels south of the border to make his mark on archaeology. The stated purpose of his expedition is to survey a temple complex known as Site R. But no sooner have Indy and his colleague, Marcus Brody, set up headquarters in the little town of Lucasio, then they realize more important issues are at stake. Everywhere they turn, thieves and scavengers, many calling themselves scientists, are ransacking historical sites and selling off their priceless treasures to the highest bidder. We'll talk about that a little bit later too. Soon, Indy is embroiled in a dangerous contest, rushing to find a series of dazzling artifacts and get them into safe hands before his unscrupulous rivals, led by the shady collector Dr. Victor Van Loon and a crackpot Nazi general Anton Schlossberg, can steal them. As the player, you are Indiana Jones. At the start of each game, you should consult with Marcus on his latest emergency. He'll supply the first item you need to get this story going. From there, it's up to you to explore, trade, and fight your way through dangerous terrain to resolve the crisis at hand. In your adventures, you will encounter fierce warriors and deadly banditos, poisonous spiders and vicious jaguars, and maybe even a snake or two. And before you're done, you will confront the uncanny forces of the ancient gods, including the mighty feathered serpents Quetzalcoatl. Oh, I knew I was going to mispronounce that. I think it's Quetzalcoatl. Why did it have to be a snake? So I mentioned story. There's not much of a story there, only because this game is LucasArts' answer to Rogue, the classic I don't know what to call it. It's of its own genre. This is the type of game where the story is in some ways completely procedurally generated and composed of the actions that the player enacts. So in this game, Indy starts his adventure with a brief conversation with Marcus, who plays the role of quest giver. Marcus never leaves his little office sitting at his table. Marcus will tell Indy what the next goal is. Sometimes it's a rescue mission, but more often than not, the quest involves recovering a sacred artifact. Now, like Rogue and most other roguelikes, Indy uses a bump attack to interact with the world. Now, I'm going to assume that most of us know what Rogue is or what a roguelike is, at least they've come across the term. A bump in roguelike language means walking into something. So, for instance, if you see a pickaxe on the ground, to pick it up, you walk Indy into it. At this point, the pickaxe will start flashing, which means you can use the mouse pointer to click on the item to add it to your inventory. Now, what I found was the mouse and keyboard interface in this game is a bit of a mixed bag. The game was really made to take advantage of the mouse, kind of like most other Windows 3.1 products. Movement and inventory are handled really well by the mouse. Holding down the left mouse button will walk Indy in the direction of the cursor. A single click takes Indy one step in the cursor's direction. A right click uses whatever his currently activated weapon is. Now, the problem I ran into is I'm a keyboard guy. I really like playing stuff with a keyboard. And the keyboard in this case is much more accurate for movement and combat. Unfortunately, you can't use the keyboard alone to do things like pick up items and use your inventory. So you do need to kind of, if you're going to play with the keyboard, you got to kind of two-hand it. One hand on the keyboard, and I hope that you have a numeric keypad for this, and your other hand on your mouse. There is some inconsistency, I think, in my opinion, with using things like objects. Indy has a slot, and to me it looked like a tool slot, like a generic slot you would use for anything, and this is something that would be common to most roguelikes. But this slot only accepts weapons. So think of this almost like a paper doll. Instead of being able to equip armor and tools and all of that other stuff, Indy's just got one single slot. It accepts weapons. And what I did was I got a pickaxe in my inventory. I thought I could equip it to use it as a tool, so I tried to drag it into the little square that holds my weapon slot, and found it goes, wouldn't let me do it. So I figured it took me a long time to figure out that this was weapons only. And this gets to a really, really important point. In order to play this game, in order to succeed at this game, you need to read the help file. It doesn't come in the box, or I should say the folio sleeve that the game is shipped in. You have to read an online help file that's built in to the game. Without reading the help file, you are going to get stuck. And there are a lot of undocumented little features. I shouldn't say undocumented. There are many documented features that aren't expressed by, you know, just playing the game and experimenting with the buttons. You really do need to learn it either by reading the help guide or, in this case, consulting an in-game character who is extremely helpful with this. This character is named Bonifacio. The Spanish guy in the center of town. I think he's supposed to be Mexican. It doesn't really say specifically where this adventure is located, so I'm just going to say Spanish. Please don't be offended if you are Spanish or from Central America or South America. I'm just saying that it is fairly ambiguous as to the real cultural context of this game. This character, Bonifacio, I don't know how to actually pronounce that. He sort of functions like a fountain of wisdom for gameplay tips as well as what to do next in the story. So for the most part, if you don't read the help file, you can get most of the gameplay tips from him. Now back to the interface. What I found was that after I read the help file, the game became a lot more playable. For instance, there are four little green arrows at the bottom of the UI, northeast, southwest. It turns out this is a compass, not the best icons to be using for this to express that it was a compass. And what it shows you is whether you are able to travel to neighboring areas. So for instance, on the current screen, oh, and this is something I should have made much clearer earlier on, I apologize. The way that the screens load is, it is not a smooth scrolling game where you can just open world explore the map. Indy has to walk to the edge of the current screen and it'll scroll over to the next available screen. Again, like the original Legend of Zelda for the NES. That is very different, let's say, than Rogue. The original Rogue, which would keep your character in the center of the screen and let you explore the entire map on your own. So what you have is neighboring areas that Indy can explore. So if you can explore the area to your east, the east green arrow will turn green. If you can't, it'll just stay grayed out. So that's really important to know which areas you can and can't get to, because most of this game is designed around exploration. The idea is that you need to really explore the entire map before you can finish the quest. Now, very helpful for this, there is a kind of auto map. I like this little trick. Instead of giving you the auto map right off the bat, you have to find it. So when you start a quest, the auto map is found in one of the neighboring kind of tiled areas, east, north, south, or west of where the town is. I really like that because it kind of makes you work for it as opposed to just having auto mapping right off the bat. I was going to go into some detail about how to interpret the auto map, but I think it's fairly straightforward, and I suggest reading the help file if you need to understand what each piece means. Now, the game does have diagonal movement, but you need the numeric keypad for this or the mouse. You can't just use the regular up, down, left, right arrows. And that's really important. Another thing I found is some objects are hidden underneath other objects, so you do need to learn how to push and pull stuff. I'll give you a quick tip. It's holding down the shift key. It took me forever to find that in the help manual. Bonifacio tells you about it too, but I accidentally missed that prompt when I was scrolling through his text. So more on that later. Now to complete the game, there was my Windows 3.1 sound by accident. you get something called an IQ or Indy quotient. This is an old holdover actually from the Indiana Jones adventure games. This is a score, in this case, out of 1,000, showing how well you did versus the highest possible score you can get in the game. Now, the IQ score is based on a few different variables: your game difficulty, so that's the combat difficulty, your game speed, and the world size. So to even attempt a score of 1,000, you need the game set to the hardest combat, the fastest speed, and the largest world size. Trust me, you probably don't want to do that. The largest world size at the fastest speed and the hardest combat is honestly just plain old annoying. On my 486 DX 4100, this is what I played the game on. This game made the game almost unplayable just because of problems with combat. Now, combat. This is not the best aspect of the game. Unfortunately, the enemies can attack you diagonally, but you cannot attack them back diagonally. Unfortunately, that makes for extremely frustrating combat. And I found that it was, probably what originally turned me off from the game. But there are some nice surprises that go with it. For instance, there's a boss key. If you hit Control H, this hides the window, so literally you can hide it from your boss while you're at work. That kind of gives you a hint at who this game was meant for. This was probably meant as a coffee break time killer kind of game that you could take for a spin in 10 or 15 minutes. My suggestion is, if you really want to have the fastest possible game, set the combat to easy, set the world size to the tiniest, the lowest part of the slider it can go, and you can probably have something playable in under 10 minutes. I really like that there's a world control slider, and this is where you specify the size of the map it generates. Large world maps will make for a much longer adventure, much more exploration, but I wouldn't say the most enjoyable thing. The tiny world maps really do make each quest finish up pretty quickly, and I like that. I mentioned Bonifacio. Really nice little thing to add, not only a kind of NPC pointer at saying, oh, here's where to go for the next part of your story, but also to tell you how to play the game if it's your first time. It was a little bit better than even a tutorial. I think a tutorial would have been annoying. Bonifacio just says, look, this is what you need to do in order to play the game well. Another nice surprise, Hal Barwood of Indiana Jones and the Fate of Atlantis fame wrote and designed this game. It won't win a screenwriting prize. And honestly, most of the dialogue you have with other characters isn't even really dialogue. They're just informational. But it does still feel pretty darn Indiana Jones. Clint Bajakian, this is LucasArts' in-house composer, did the music and the sound effects. And the sound effects are silly. These are random sound effects you would have probably found on a Macintosh in 1995. But the music is surprisingly good. These are classic, you know, typical John Williams renditions, but they sound good, and I'm sure you've heard those at the start of this episode. Now, as I mentioned, there are some not-so-nice surprises. One of the things is that the folio package that the game comes in does not have a manual. I was really looking forward to reading a manual, to be honest, because I'm one of those people that actually enjoys reading good, heavy, thick, classic manuals. So this means you have to read the README file. It's very succinct, very well written, but again, this would have been nice to see this in a paper guide. Enemies can attack you diagonally. This is something I mentioned earlier. This kind of violates what I consider to be a cardinal rule of roguelike combat, that if your enemy can attack you diagonally, you should be able to attack your enemy, bump attack your enemy diagonally back the same way, unfortunately. And this is just due to the way that the game is designed, because in this game you actually don't bump attack. You have to face the enemy and then hit the space bar to attack with your weapon. That doesn't work. Let's talk a little bit about tech stuff. So Indie uses the WinG graphics library to manage its graphics display. One of the things I noticed very, very visibly, and this is both in the the DOSBox version of Windows 3.1 I'm using, as well as on my trusty Packard Bell Legend 486, I noticed was a lot of flicker and judder in the way the screen looks when Indie walks. So if you take a step, and you get some judder and wonkiness in the screen, it's because Indie is walking from tile to tile and the game redraws the entire screen. That's very computationally expensive. That's a very expensive way to redraw tiles. And it's obvious that the Desktop Adventures engine is either pushing WinG very, very hard, or it's not taking advantage of certain WinG calls that would make screen refreshes faster. There are a lot of different techniques to repainting a screen, dealing with dirty rectangles, all that kind of stuff. I want to get to that in a much later episode. This is not going to be for quite some time because I got a lot of research I'll need to do on this, on how WinG works as a graphics library. So no judgment to the programmers of the game. I'm just saying that it's one little funny thing that you do notice that WinG was used here just because of the way the screen repaints work. One other funny thing I ran into, and this is not to do with the game, this is actually, in fact, a limitation of Windows 3.1. When I first started playing the game, I noticed there was no music, and in my head I thought, no, I remember, like 20 years ago, there was definitely the Indiana Jones, I think it was called the Raiders March, playing when you started the game. And I was looking forward to that, and when I loaded the game, it didn't play. And I thought, well, what's going on here? So I spent some time trying to figure this out. And this was on my DOSBox version of Windows 3.1. It took me a while to realize that I had WinGroove installed. WinGroove is a software-based synthesizer that uses the Sound Blaster's wave output. So the way a software synth works is it gets MIDI data from the MIDI system. It takes a bunch of real samples and uses those to output, instead over the nice hardware-driven chips, it uses a software-based synth that uses a ton of CPU in order to pump out some really cool sound. I really like Windgroove for that. So you basically kind of get a wavetable synth for free using Windgroove. What I forgot was that Windows does not Windows 3.1 does not play well with multiple wave sounds competing for the same audio channels on the Sound Blaster. So if you have a wave playing already, so for instance, if you have a movie playing that has sound and you hit a try to play a wave file at the same time, it's not going to work. It's actually just going to play nothing for the wave file, and it's going to keep playing on the audio channel for the movie. And the same thing went for Indiana Jones. Indiana Jones uses wave sounds for all of the silly, you know, whip sound or the whenever you kill an enemy. And so that took over the Sound Blaster 16's wave output, meaning that Windgroove couldn't use it. So what I had to do was use something called the MIDI mapper. The MIDI mapper, I don't think I'll do a full episode on this, but maybe I'll do an episode on sound and MIDI in Windows 3.1. The MIDI mapper's purpose is to let you control which MIDI channels go to which MIDI output devices. So you kind of get to rewire input to output here. In my case, all 16 MIDI channels were pointed at Windgroove, so Windgroove could play its beautiful output. So a bunch of clicking later, I was able to switch back to the Creative Music Synthesizer for MIDI output. And this is the Sound Blaster's built-in hardware OPL3 synthesizer. I think it sounds great. So that was Windows 3.1. On my trusty Pac Bell Legend, I actually have an AW64 Gold. I love it. And that output outputted the music you heard at the start and the end of this episode. So that's not OPL3. That's actually coming over the very cool EMU synth built into the AW64 Gold. Now, other things I found, you can't really run other programs while Desktop Adventures is running. I actually got an out-of-memory error just trying to load Media Player at the same time. I was going to see if I could force it to play MIDI at the same time. You can't. That's because running, despite, you know, Windows 3.1 running in 386 enhanced mode, Desktop Adventure still consumes a bunch of conventional memory. Again, conventional memory being that first 640 kilobytes of RAM. I was really surprised by that. I thought Desktop Adventures would take advantage of EMS or XMS, meaning, you know, that 1 meg and upwards part of the memory. Well, it doesn't. It consumes a bunch of stuff and consumes a bunch of conventional memory. So that's something to watch for. If you get out of memory errors running Desktop Adventures, that's because it is a pig for conventional memory. Another thing to keep your eyes out for is if you're running this on original hardware, like a Mach 64 or Diamond Stealth 64, an STB, Sprint PCI, even the Ensoniq Soundscape 2000 or MediaVision Pro Audio Spectrum, that's the PAS, you may encounter some problems with this game. This is covered in the README file. I'm not going to go into any detail about it, but if you do run into kind of visual graphical corruption, that probably means switching your desktop color depth, upgrading your video card drivers, or if you run into clicky poppy sound or no sound at all, you're probably going to have to upgrade your sound card drivers. There are a bunch of notes. Refer to the README file for it. I refer to the help file for it. It surprised me how much work LucasArts put into testing this on various hardware to find out what kind of limitations there were. This game came out during kind of a transitional time for LucasArts. There must have been a lot of questions about how to deal with Windows, because The Dig came out a year earlier, a year before that was Full Throttle, and these were all DOS-based games. LucasArts had not really made the successful transition into Windows yet, and with Windows 95 coming out and supporting things like DirectX eventually, this must have, those APIs must have given the ability of developers to introduce their DOS-based games into the next era. I think this is why this is a somewhat uncomfortable title. In fact, I think this might be one of LucasArts' only Windows 3.1 titles. Please, somebody correct me if I'm wrong. I didn't look that up. It uses its own engine. It was written from scratch. and developed by a little team led by Hal Barwood. And I found a wonderful interview with Hal Barwood in I believe it was a Indiana Jones fan site. The question the interview asks is, when did the idea of desktop adventures first arise? Hal replies, I like storytelling, and I also like classic rhythmic replayable games like Stratego or chess. It occurred to me that I might be able to split story and game elements into small chunks and find ways of algorithmically assembling them into replayable action adventures. So I did. I built a working prototype on a Mac in HyperCard using the scripting language called HyperTalk. The prototype story had nothing to do with Jones. It took place in a post-apocalyptic future where only an elite few know how to repair and maintain the few vital machines that preserve some semblance of human civilization. It was called Tools of the Tinker's Trade. Now, I would have thought that Hal Barwood took his cue from Rogue, because the game feels like Rogue. The random, the procedural generation, the random generation is very roguelike, and he put a lot of work into making things like pathways. There are no dead ends in the game. Everything will always work out. The game will always be solvable unless you hit a bug, and I haven't seen one yet. So, continuing on with the interview, the interviewer asks a little bit about the production. Was it created as an established concept, or did you have to start from scratch? And Hal replied, I'm hardly the first to figure out how to recombine game elements, but the desktop adventure idea was the first to concentrate on replayable storylines. And yep, I started from scratch, again referencing the Tools of the Tinker's Trade game. LucasArts salespeople couldn't figure out how to sell the idea, even though Solitaire and Hearts and their ilk were already popular on PC desktops. Agreed, Hal. They were probably the most important, the most popular games that came out for Windows 3.1. So Hal continues, so marketplace security in the form of what came in the form of Dr. Jones. Unfortunately, that didn't really work. The game generated negative reviews from people who were expecting cutting-edge graphics and sound from Lucas and not desktop toys, and it barely sold. Hal says, personally, I much prefer the second version of the game, Yoda Stories. We improved the engine quite a bit to make predicting outcomes a little less trivial, and not only that, it sold really well. Too bad we didn't make some more of these things. Now, this is really funny. Hal doesn't really reference Rogue as an influence in this game, but when the interviewer asks him what his favorite game is, he says, to pick one out of the crowd is tough. The first one that I thought demonstrated creative charm was Rogue. It combined a vague narrative with minimalist X and Y geometry good enough to make me feel like I was exploring a world. The title that encouraged me to actively pursue a career in video games was the original Castle Wolfenstein. I thought it was fun, and its many little conceptual errors flattered me into thinking I could do better. The more you learn, though, the harder your heart becomes, and in more recent times, less stands out from the crowd, even though the average game is of much higher quality today than when I got started. Well, Hal, you're not alone, because one of the games that I saw cited as a major influence for the id Software guys was also Castle Wolfenstein, which became Wolf 3D. So, not a huge in-depth development history here, unfortunately, just because the game didn't sell well, it wasn't marketed very aggressively by LucasArts. I think the real story here in the development is the fact that this game came out at all. I suspect this was probably a bit of a skunkwork project over at LucasArts just to test what was possible on the Windows 3.1 platform before they actually had anything like Curse of Monkey Island, which would come out a year later. So this is unfortunately that awkward middle child before LucasArts made its full transition into Windows 95 DirectX gaming, but I think it's a very worthwhile game, again, if only for 10 to 15 minutes of fun. I'm sure you'll talk to many people today who will know of a million other indie roguelike games that will be better serve your time now. But for Windows 3.1, this is certainly a highlight. In future episode, I hope to talk about Yoda Stories, which was this game taken to let's say, a slightly higher level of quality, as well as better storytelling and better world generation. So thank you for allowing me to share with you another episode of Multimedia Hyper Guide for Windows. I'm looking forward to our next one. I haven't made any decisions on what it is, but I at least know that it will come out on Sunday this time. So see you in less than 7 days.